of the House Community and Regional Affairs will now come to order. It is 8:05 a.m. Tuesday, May 2nd, 2023 in Capital Room 124. Members present are Vice Chair McCabe, Representative McKay, Representative Ruffridge, Representative Henshute, Representative Mears, and myself, Representative McCormick, Chair. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Please take this time to silence your cell phones for the duration of the meeting. Before we begin, I would like to thank Linda Jensen, the House CNRA Secretary for Records, and Kelsey Riker from the Juneau LIO for staffing the committee today. Today we have one item on the agenda. We will continue our presentation from the Department of Environmental Conservation, and hopefully this time we can get it done. If not, we will certainly invite you back again. So, please, Director Annie Bates and Program Manager Terry Bohan, please come forward. Put yourself on the record, and I believe we stopped off on slide 9, if I'm not mistaken. So I think we can just take it up from there.
Good morning. For the record, Carrie Bohan. I'm the Facilities Program Manager with the Department of Environmental Conservation's Division of Water. So it looks like this morning we're starting with a discussion of the application process for Village Safe Water projects. We're actually in the midst of that right now. Friday is the application deadline for new construction, design, and construction projects. I may have mentioned this previously, that all projects, in order to be eligible for construction funding, have to have had a planning effort that looks at various alternatives, so that we're looking at both constructability, operations and maintenance, and capital costs in those planning efforts. And then we have a review committee that's comprised of the different DEC programs that provide some sort of approval of solid waste, drinking water, wastewater during that construction process, and then all of the funding agencies come together. And so in doing that collaborative approach, our hope is that a community walks away from that process with a planning document that could lead to a funded project from any of the funding agencies. So we gather a scoring committee of the federal funding partners, ANTHC, and we score every project based primarily 40% on the beneficial impacts that the project is going to provide. Then we look at the current level of service, so the unserved and underserved communities receive priority points. Then we do look at the technical, financial, and managerial capacity of the community, and there's some small points allotted to what, if there's another project that's going on or could be coordinated with for efficiency, we would want to try and promote that type of activity. And then we look at the quality of the application, and they're all generally of high quality, so it doesn't add or take away too much in that regard. And then once a project is selected for funding, we may choose to fund just design in the first go-round. That's often a two-year process, and it results in a more accurate cost estimate that we can then fund the construction activities in a subsequent year based on that new estimate. And in some cases, particularly if we're using force account labor, where there's local laborers doing the work, we'll need to fund that project over the course of many years. And that also allows us to have funding to multiple projects at once and not have one project during a specific fiscal year gobble up all the dollars so that we're only funding that project. We've got many projects going at different phases at one time. And all of those projects are listed on the multi-year priority list. Once we commit to funding, we commit to funding it until it's complete. So this is just a quick look at a handful of the projects that Village Safe Water is constructing right now. We are developing a new water source in Unalakleet and also replacing the entire drinking water distribution system. It's one of the oldest distribution systems, and it's also one of the largest communities that we serve. And they're having regular routine failures of the distribution system that are leading to loss of water and freeze-ups. So this is a pretty substantial project, but one that we're really excited to see moving along. Also new water treatment plants and washed areas in both Wales and New Napachuk. Lift station replacement in St. Paul. We're also looking at a new water intake and transmission line in Shaktuluk, as well as constructing a water storage tank in St. George. And like I said, that's just a sampling of the projects that we have ongoing. So for state fiscal year 24, our capital request is quite substantial. The bulk of that is for accepting Indian Health Service and EPA dollars that are allocated through the Indian Health Service's funding system, the sanitation deficiency system. But the communities that are supported by Village Safe Water for construction purposes are receiving those dollars, and so they'll come to us and we'll administer those projects. And then the remainder is for us to be able to accept the EPA and USDA rural development dollars that are allocated to the state and then are required 25% match to those. And these are used for a combination of both providing first-time service and then improvements to existing systems. Once utilities are built, we provide support. I know on April 20th, I believe, was the first time we were here, and the Rural Utility Business Advisor program was discussed by Director Moeller from Commerce. We have a similar program that focuses just on the operations, the technical side of operating the utilities. That's the Remote Maintenance Worker Program. So we use portions of both the EPA and USDA grants. We partner with regional health corporations. So we have five regional health corporations that we work with. And then where there's not a willing partner in a region, DEC has three staff that also provide that same type of support, primarily in Southeast, South Central, and the Aleutians. DEC provides that support. So we have a total of 15 individuals. They provide, hopefully, training and preventative maintenance type efforts, but they do often and probably most notoriously respond to emergencies 365 days a year, generally in the worst of weather. And so then we've provided just some examples of just the quantity of assistance that they provide during an average year, 48 emergency trips. They are on their cell phones, text messages, telephone calls, day and night, every day, and have developed really good relationships within the community. So they are generally the first to receive a call if something's not going well. And then just looking at some other activities that we have ongoing, a little more than 10 years ago, the department and EPA and others were in a situation where there was not enough money to provide pipe service to all of the remaining unserved communities. And the per capita or the per home cost was just so great that the question that arose was, is there a way that we could provide a higher level of health benefit at a cost that's not, at that time it was somewhere in the neighborhood of $500,000 per home, and we know now it's closer to $1 million. Something that was not fully pipe service, but an alternative. And so there was an effort to solicit international teams and essentially have this water and sewer competition or challenge. And so the goal was to have teams develop prototypes for in-home water reuse with a target capital cost of $160,000 per unit, where residents could bring in a smaller amount of water, have it treated after use, some of it be reused, and reduce the amount of back and forth hauling that was going on. And so fast forward to today, the University of Alaska Anchorage team was the most successful in demonstrating that they could produce something that could actually meet all of our objectives. They are testing their unit in the university one of the condo style dorm units in the garage. And they have some students who are contributing water. They're not using any of the treated water at this point. That would be our next stage. And so it's our hope that, later in the year, we'll see the results of that first phase of testing, and they'll be able to move into the next phase, which would actually be some of the students making use of the recycled water, and then looking to potentially deploy in homes that maybe are too far from the pipe service in a served community, where it's just unreasonably expensive to get a pipe there. We do know, too, in some pipe communities, there are residents who fall off the system for one reason or the other. And so even though there is substantial funding to provide pipe service in the unserved communities, we still see this as a valuable effort to continue, especially with as far as we've come.
Representative Hemshute.
Thank you. Through the chair, so this would be like bringing a container out and setting it next to the house that has these in it, because houses out there don't have garages either. So the idea is to have a contained system that is brought to the community and to the home.
Through the chair, Representative Hemshute, that's exactly the idea. And I know the pictures are probably very small, but the picture on the left shows the first prototype. This is on the campus of the university, and they were using a half Connex and fit the treatment equipment in there. But yes, it would be a separate building adjacent to a home and potentially serving more one or two homes is also an option we're looking at.
And so when you say recycling, so the water would recirculate within the unit, where does the wastewater exit to?
Through the chair. So, right, it would capture gray water, and that would be treated for reuse, and then the wastewater is disposed of through either a hauled out or through a septic system type setup.
Thank you.
So I feel like we're finally getting to some summary pages. Thank you for allowing us to come back and continue to share this information with you so many times. So some of the challenges that we're facing, and I think we've probably touched on some of these previously, is the Indian Health Service funding is there's sufficient funding to provide pipe service to the unserved communities and the underserved communities. However, that funding is going to be awarded without consideration of the community's capacity, and it is something that concerns us whether or not there's sufficient support for those communities once the service is provided. In all of those projects, there are going to be components that Indian Health Service considers ineligible for their funding, and so there are gaps to be filled. The EPA, Denali Commission, Rural Development, all contribute funding outside of the Village Safe Water process. For the first year of bill funding, that was enough to cover all the gaps. And just by the numbers, it should be enough to cover gaps in future years. But that continues to be something that, as a group, we collaborate on to make sure that there's no holes left unfilled. And then across the industry, we're seeing a struggle for staffing, whether it's engineers, contractors, or laborers. And both that demand and materials are a challenge, the availability of materials. And then costs are just skyrocketing. And we had projects that we had to put on hold for COVID purposes when we couldn't have construction crews coming into the community. unfortunately, pausing those projects now when we go to pick them back up, all of the inflationary costs, we're having to go back and find additional funding to fill gaps just to get those projects off the ground. So, again, it's something that we're working with the federal funding partners to make sure those previously committed projects are able to move forward. And then the Infrastructure Act created the Build America, Buy America requirements, and we just, at this point, don't have sufficient federal guidance on how to implement that. So it is also something that is a bit of a challenge for us right now, but we hope that we'll see guidance from the federal funding partners soon. So that's all the information I had to share on Village Safe Water. But I did have a couple slides to share on another funding program that we operate, and that is the State Revolving Fund. This is a low-interest loan program. We receive grants from EPA each year to capitalize our loan fund. We contribute a 20% state match, but we're able to do that by using our revenue generated off our interest earnings. So we don't submit requests for match funds. The capitalization grants have been affected by the federal earmarks, the water and sewer projects that were funded through earmarks. That total dollar amount was taken off the national appropriation for the state revolving funds. And so that means where we had been seeing about $10 million to each fund annually, this year we'll see about half that to each of the loan funds.
Thanks. So, yeah, I do have a question on this, and it has more to do with the process. So you, DEC knows of the 47, I think you said, underserved communities that fit under the Village Safe Water Act, and we discussed at the last meeting that there are many more communities out there that could use a well house or something like that. So do you go out there and or send letters or somehow talk to the governing bodies, if you will, such as the Talkeetna Community Council, which is an incorporated council, and say, hey, we have this program here. We understand from Representative McCabe that you need a well. Here's a funding source. Would you send them a letter, or is it incumbent on them to approach you?
Through the chair, Vice Chair McCabe, thank you. That's a good question. I think we've had a pool of regular borrowers. There's about 40 communities that regularly come to us for loans. And I think in recent years, we've had some staffing changes, and we have maybe not been as proactive as we could have been in reaching out to communities. But at this point, we have so much money. Well, on the next slide, you'll see that this program is being funded through the infrastructure bill. We are knocking on every door. EPA has also funded some technical assistance providers, and we're working with them to do an outreach program. So looking at every community, every entity that could be eligible for this program, reaching out to them, asking, could we come and provide some free assistance to assess your needs in your community and then help you understand the path to getting funding and even maybe helping you with the applications and such. So we are really making a big push to make sure everyone knows that we're here and that we have funding available.
Perfect. Great answer. Thanks.
I did actually reach out to Talkeetna. We played some phone tag, but they had already submitted a project questionnaire for the State Revolving Fund.
Okay, thanks.
So for this process, we used to do a once-a-year funding cycle, much like Village Safe Water, but shortly after I joined the program, I came to appreciate that we were seeing a lot of projects that were placeholders, where there's one I can think of here in Juneau to do some work on Douglas, and they wanted to align it with a DOT project. And so for 10 years, we saw this project on the list. And they were not pursuing it. They just needed to be on the list to be eligible for funding when the timing was right with DOT. And it made it very hard for us to make funding decisions when there were those placeholders on the list. So we adjusted our process. We now accept letters of interest throughout the year. We review them every 3 times a year, update our project priority list, and make new funds available. And that way, it offers communities access to the money when they really need it, and when they know they've got a project that is ready to pursue.
Vice Chairman Cape.
That brings up one more question. I appreciate the answers. This revolving loan and the IJA money and that sort of money, are they still going to be subject to the population limits of the Village Safe Water Act, or is this outside that?
Through the chair, Vice Chair McCabe, this is a completely separate program. So there's a separate set of eligibility requirements. It's a little bit different drinking water from clean water, but essentially it's municipalities and privately owned utilities that are regulated by the RCA, the Regulatory Commission of Alaska.
Okay. Can we expound on follow-up? Sorry. Can we expound on the privately owned? You know, I mean, so I know you're aware of what Talkeetna is. I mean, it's a census-defined area. It's not really a municipality. You know, it's got 1,199 people at the last census, I think, but they do have an incorporated community council, so they have somebody that's authorized to receive funds. But what is the RCA requirement? First time I think I've heard of that requirement. And maybe it's better you can just direct me to a statute or the RCA thing, and I can read it myself if you don't really want to go into it.
Through the chair, I'm very happy to address it. I think so I have to giving you my best guess as to why that exists. The RCA looks at the burden to the communities of the rates, makes certain that the utilities aren't charging rates that are overly burdensome and are reasonable and what have you. And so for the privately owned utilities, I think that was initially intended to be sort of a gatekeeper, if you will, to make sure that we were making loans to utilities that could afford to pay them back without burdening their customers. At this point, it's a rather archaic requirement, and it actually can be rather burdensome both for us and for our customers. So I think it's just unfortunately part of our statute.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, so we're actually in the midst of this funding process right now as well. We are hoping to public notice next week, if all goes well, our intended use plans. These are requirements of applying for the federal grants, and it lists out basically our game plan for the year, how much money we're getting, who's applied, and how we plan to administer the program and spend the money. And we'll be making new loan funds available this summer. And so this is a program, as I mentioned, that received significant funding increases through the infrastructure bill. So for the drinking water program, we'll receive $18 million that can be used for any project. And 49% of that is we're obligated to give 49% of that away as subsidy. So we do that as loan forgiveness. We also are eligible for $28 million in lead service line replacement. This is a new requirement. Let me step back. There's a requirement for all community water systems to do an inventory to determine if they have lead service lines. That's due by the end October 24. And then if they do have lead service lines, we have funding for them to replace those. Very obviously, this was something that was crafted for the East Coast and other parts of the country. It's very unlikely that we can make use of $28 million because we're a young enough state that we just don't have that much lead, which is fantastic. So we will use as much as we possibly can. And then there's also $7.5 million available for addressing emerging contaminants, most prominently PFAS. And this all has to be given as loan forgiveness. Similarly, we get $564,000 in clean water emerging contaminant funds, again, with a focus on PFAS, and then just shy of $11 million for any eligible SRF project. Some of the funding sources have very specific rules about how much of that money must go to disadvantaged communities. This is really something that was stressed as part of the infrastructure bill. We are presently working on a revision to our definition of disadvantaged communities because our statutes are in our regulations. Actually, I believe it's our regulations require that we only give our subsidy to disadvantaged communities, even where the federal requirement is broader than that. So that will also be part of our public notice effort with our intended use plans, hopefully next week. And that is remarkably all I've got.
You made it.
Third time was the charm.
Any questions? I guess I'll go first. My first question just is, you might be aware of House Bill 178 in finance. I was curious if you feel like that will make any substantial changes to the process or if it will just generally be the same.
Good morning. For the record, Randy Bates, Director of Water, Department of Environmental Conservation. Chair McCormick, thank you for the question. We are aware of that House bill. We did testify last week in House Finance with the sponsor and the members there. The way the additional sentence is worded and the lack of definitions associated with key terms in there, what we testified to is that that bill would have no change or difference. It would not make a difference in how we are currently implementing our capacity assessment or awarding of funding.
Representative Mears.
Thank you. So how we kind of start off things here a few days ago was some concerns for some communities that were not meeting the threshold for scoring. And I've since heard there's some grant funds available to help communities with the building blocks to be able to get there. Is that something you can share some more information with the committee about?
Sure. I think she's talking about AML. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Through the chair, there's actually several different opportunities out there. There's always been the Rural Utility Business Advisor and the Remote Maintenance Worker Programs. But we did learn last week that the Alaska Municipal League is going to receive grant funding through EPA. I believe that their particular award is targeting at wastewater systems. But as we know, most of the communities that we're talking about in rural Alaska have one operator that's responsible for the water system and the wastewater system and maybe several other things in the community. And so we always do all of our technical assistance with that in mind, that it's benefiting both the water and wastewater systems. And I don't see why that would be different for this funding opportunity with AML. And then I think it's further focused on financing and funding of projects, and so helping communities get to that point. It was originally, I think, tied to the infrastructure funding for the state revolving fund. However, it's very clear that it's meant to be for small, rural, and I believe tribal communities.
Follow up.
Yes, thank you, through the chair. So do you think that this is going to help a lot of those communities get to that point where they're eligible for the funding that's got those federal requirements we were talking about?
Through the chair, Representative Mears, I hope that's the case. We've been discussing with AML for a couple of years different opportunities. I know that they're quite interested in being involved in this process. There's more work than there are entities to provide assistance, so I don't think we'll see a glut in assistance. So I'm very hopeful that this will make an impact.
Representative McKay.
Yes.
Me, McKay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. through the chair, I just thank you for the opportunity and thanks for being here. I'm just kind of curious, you know,
I always try to, is there an end to this? Or, you know, we've got 47 villages. Do we complete two villages per year, three, four, five? Is there any kind of progression here where we could maybe see the end, you know, of 10 years from now, 15 years from now? Do you gauge your progress? Is there any way you can give us a prediction of, you know, in 2035, we'll be done with this and everybody will be, it'll all be great? Or how do you look at it? Give us some hope.
Through the chair, Representative McKay. So it presently, the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, using Indian Health Service funding, is doing these expansive planning efforts to look at, is pipe service the right alternative? And there are some communities that I believe have already made the decision that that isn't the appropriate path for them. They are moving through those planning efforts as quickly as possible and teeing them up for funding. So I do believe that there are probably five or six that are due to be funded this year. So I'm just, off the top of my head, I would say design is a two-year process, especially for something as substantial as this. And then the construction is probably a five-year effort. So if each one of these takes about 7 years and the last ones are funded 5 years from now, so in 15 years, I think we'll see substantial progress. However, I would also say that we know many of these communities are going to struggle to support those facilities. We are already on an annual basis funding improvements to existing facilities. We have 40-year-old systems that have had little maintenance or are constructed of materials that are no longer really appropriate and are breaking down, such as Unalakleet. So there might be a resolution to the unserved communities, but this is an ongoing process well beyond the infrastructure funding to help these communities maintain the systems that they have. Most of the communities are able to reserve a small amount of repair and replacement dollars, but they are not budgeting or planning for replacement of their entire utility. They know that grant funds have been available, and that's really been their method for improvements.
Quick follow-up. So if you don't go for pipe service, what's the alternative? Just curious.
Through the chair, I think there are some communities that have a haul system that they may choose to stick with that. Wells and septics are an excellent option if the ground conditions are conducive and there's available groundwater for that to happen. So there are certainly some communities that are moving in that direction too.
Thank you, Chair.
Any other questions? Vice Chair McCade.
Thank you. Through the chair, so this might be a little bit more complicated question for this hearing, but what would it take to make HB 178 a better, a more viable bill, or to do exactly what they wanted to do? I mean, I have HB 114, which is in this committee right now for a hearing, and it's specifically targeted at Talkeetna, but there's five other communities that are affected as well. You know, maybe putting them together, maybe some amendments for 178 that would help to do, maybe we could do it all together since it all kind of deals with village safe water and septic and that sort of thing. Maybe we could craft something to put them all together and do what several of us would like to do.
Thank you, Vice Chair McCabe. Through the chair, great question. Thank you. I think that we haven't had any conversation with the sponsors of the bill to understand more what they're particularly looking for. I think we've got some federal requirements we have to follow first and foremost. So we have to, as a primacy agency, address the capacity issue. We do that through that O&M best practice scores, working with our RUBA partner and the communities. And so the capacity assessment has to occur. I think what the bill is trying to get at is getting around that assessment in some way, reestablishing the need or bypassing scores as a tool, a predictor of capacity. Right now, and I think we talked about this in this committee, we also talked about it in House Finance, through Carrie's program, she has surveyed all of the facilities on what's working, what's not working. We intend to, as soon as we get that report back from the consultant, initiate a solicitation from all of our communities that have these facilities to understand what their challenges are with the scores and the development of capacity. And then once we get those comments back, we'll take a hard look at those and figure out if scores remain an effective tool for predicting or assessing capacity for the communities. So what we're working on, Representative, is trying to improve the existing structure that we have. We have to deliver service in a better way than we have been. We recognize this 3 years ago. We saw the trending scores of communities and their best practice scores. We started working with our sister agency at Commerce to improve the delivery of service. They have added positions. They have added funding. They have made it a priority to travel to the communities in a more proactive and significant manner. And we also see that AML Municipal League has secured that grant that is going to, in many ways, supplement that effort. So right now, the goal is, within the given framework that we have, improve our delivery of service so that the communities are building that capacity without having to change anything structurally. We just have to follow the federal rules. We have a system in place. It has been functional, and it's setting the communities up. If we can work this correctly, it'll set the communities up for success long-term. And that's the ultimate goal with capacity and the infrastructure, is get something built and allow the communities to operate it independently, safely for their residents and sustainably for the long-term.
Follow up?
No, please. Yes.
Thanks. So I appreciate that. And I know you and I are working with probably the poster child of what happens when the community fails somehow, or the system fails and the community can't support the repairs that needed. And I get that. So I think the tool, the assessment tool, is important. And I also think maybe it needs to develop a little bit. I don't think that we should be going around it necessarily, because we need to know if a community can support it. Is a community growing? Is it shrinking? Will it have a increase the tax and employee base, or will it have a less of a means to support a sewer system? Having said that, I guess my ask to you is, we have two bills in play right now that deal with this, and sooner than later, if you come up with a way to make those bills better, they've already been, you know, they're already working, and if we can make them better to help you with the tool and with the federal government, and I know that the IJA money and that sort of stuff, then you know, I'm happy to help, and I know everybody on this committee is happy to help. So, you know, just let us know whatever we can do to, you know, push this along. It would be a kind of a shame to waste this opportunity, if you ask me. So,
absolutely, Vice Chair McCabe, through the chair, thank you. We're absolutely interested. You heard Carrie also say there is an archaic provision in one of our statutes specific to that SRF program, the state revolving fund, that's related to the RCA. And that's a piece that we've been looking at for a couple of years to provide some simple changes to a statute would provide a significant eligibility issue, expansion to a number of entities that could and should be making these funds available, especially with the numbers that she showed you. There's three big pots of money out there, and we intend to use it all to the extent we can, and the communities have a need for it. So,
thanks.
Representative Hemshue.
Thank you. Through the chair, I'm on slide 13, and I guess it's just kind of sticking with me. Every community that you're talking about has been through your best practice tool, and should be set up to maintain things, and yet you required 48 emergency trips by personnel to keep things going. Do you have a sense over the years, this is your 22 accomplishments, over the years, is that number pretty standard, 48 trips a year to for communities that have the capacity and have scored well on best practices, still required 50 emergency visits, and that's typical?
Through the chair, Representative Himshu, I think 50 is average for the last several years. We've seen certainly years where it's quite a bit higher. You raised some interesting points. So we started using the best practice scoring criteria in 2015, and prior to that, there was the more arduous RUBA assessment. So you're right, communities that have ServiceNow have been through a capacity assessment prior to their construction funding, but the capacity of the communities varies over time. And I think that's pretty consistent for every community. There's often, we call them champions in the community who come in and work really hard and they move on for some reason or another, and the capacity takes a plummet, and then there's a real effort to sort of support and rebuild that. So it's very cyclic, and even communities that have shown in the past great capacity don't always maintain it consistently. Also, there's other changes in weather conditions, acts of weather that we're seeing that we've not seen before. So there's, changing climate situations are also affecting how the utilities are operating, the ground shifts and the infrastructure shifts. We have, changes in when things thaw and freeze, and that affects the utilities as well. And so I think things are not as predictable as they used to be, and that's also resulting in some emergencies that maybe we hadn't seen in the past.
Can I add a little bit? Representative Himshu, through the chair, Carrie mentioned the changing climate, and I'm not sure if the community of Angoon is in your district. It is. Last year, if you remember, we had a significant cold spell early, and Angoon, with a somewhat shallow system like many of us in Southeast, we're not used to those 20 below hard freezes, and they had a unrelated to capacity, they had a significant freezing issue, and we needed to provide some assistance to them, both drinking water and their system froze up. So it's, and we've said this internally, we've said it to all of our RMWs, we've said it to all of our staff, the RMWs, like the Coast Guard, rarely operate in good weather. We don't have breakdowns when it's warm and balmy. It is when it's 20, 30, 40 below. And they're the ones out there. They fly in. They get there. They spend days in these communities with leather gloves in water, and it's not always clean water. They are heroes. They are the wintertime heroes that provide support to the communities.
Follow up.
Thank you. Yes, follow up through the chair. I don't know if I can say this without sounding grumpy, so I'll just go ahead and say it. It's 2023. We have communities living with less than sanitary conditions in our state and have had. If there is a regulatory barrier to getting service to those communities, my office wants a call from you, mm-hmm. because I don't know what those regulatory barriers are. So if the RCA part of the statute is holding us back, by all means, call me. And I will produce a bill, and I will get the support, and we will change whatever needs to be changed, because I know you guys are working hard, but we need to work harder
sure.
for these communities. So I expect a phone call from you as soon as you have something ready that we can, an actionable item to remove the regulatory barriers. I'm all in, so thanks.
Thank you.
Are there any further?
Is it grumpy? Sorry.
Oh, your grumpiness is appreciated, Representative Himshu. Are there any other questions? I guess I'll take another stab at this. What would you say is the biggest barrier to bringing some of these services to underserved communities?
Representative, Chair McCormick, just for clarity, when you talk services, we're talking about the building and construction of the sanitation system.
Correct.
Yeah. It's a whole laundry list. Money, time.
Chair McCormick, I think historically we've always said it was the money, right? That's always been the problem. And clearly through the infrastructure bill, that's not the case with the funding that Indian Health Services is receiving. I think the biggest barrier right now is a clear path for the communities to be sustainable once the infrastructure is built. And if we don't address that now, and there are many that are of the mind to, if you build it, they will pay. But that's, as you can see, we take approximately $6 million a year from the funding that we do have for Village Safe Water to support the Rural Utility Business Advisor and Remote Maintenance Worker programs. And they're really just there to offer the slightest amount of support to keep the communities that do have utilities operating. ANTHC also contributes millions of dollars to supporting communities. There are several organizations, including the Alaska Rural Utility Collaborative, the Northwest Arctic Boroughs Community Assistance Program, that are contributing millions of dollars to subsidize utilities. But that isn't something that's available to all the remaining unserved communities. And so I would say that's our biggest concern, is how can we move forward and be a partner in this effort and support the communities without hanging them out to dry at the end?
Sure.
Go ahead. I was just going to, Vice Chair McCabe raised his hand, so if you have a comment to add to that, please go right ahead.
I'll listen.
So, thank you. Through the chair, I suspect that you're going to tell me, I'm just going to ask it, what's the biggest cost driver for managing the utilities? Is it personnel? Is it power? Is it, fuel? I mean, I suspect it's going to be power. It's going to come down to power, which is what all the villages struggle with and why it's costing so much. But maybe you can tell me I'm wrong.
Through the chair, Vice Chair McCabe, you're not wrong. In the communities that remain unserved, we're primarily talking about northern and western Alaska. I believe ANTHC shared a statistic that about 40% of the total operational costs come from the energy. Most of those utilities have to heat their water. They circulate it year-round in order to keep it from freezing. And they're, using diesel to do this. So that is certainly the most substantial cost. But there are others.
Thanks.
Representative Ruffridge.
Thank you, Chair McCormick. I guess that just brings up another question. I mean, we're obviously not the only Arctic environment on the planet. Is there other tricks of the trade that are being used in other Arctic environments for sanitation or water supply, or is this sort of the only way? How have people that maybe been dealing with Arctic sanitation maybe a little longer than Alaska, how do they handle some of these situations?
Through the chair, Representative Ruffridge, we certainly have over the years looked into what other states are doing. There was a symposium several years ago that brought in other Arctic nations to talk about these same types of things. And I think we do our best to learn from them where possible. For example, right now we're piloting what I would call a slight improvement over a honey bucket, which is a separating toilet. So you're separating solids from liquids. This came from Scandinavia, and it just is a safer way of hauling out the waste because you don't have a mixed bucket that's sloshing around. Sorry, it's early in the morning for that type of conversation, but such is my life. So we certainly have looked at things. Some of the models I don't think are appropriate for Alaska. In northern Canada, for example, they build utilities in a hub community, and that's where they offer the services, and people who want the services then move there, and they're subsidized and run by the government. So I don't think that's a path that we're looking for. But we certainly have been, and I know ANTHC as well have been looking at examples from other parts of the country.
Follow up? Chair, Mr. Chair. Thank you. If I can come back to the general question you asked, one of the, just to be very clear, I want this committee to know, this is not one-time funding, one fiscal year. This is five fiscal years worth of significant money for the infrastructure program and the SRF program. There is ongoing money, both federal and state match, for the Village Safe Water program. We're going to have what appears to be 10 years worth of construction and operation work to be able to expend these monies. So I understand the rush. I understand the tension about getting in, getting eligible capacity. But we also have a little bit of time. And you've heard me say and commit that it is our goal and our commitment to spend every available dollar that is appropriate and available to Alaska to assist in the building of these facilities, as well as the supporting of the communities to build that capacity to be able to own and operate these. So there's tension and pressure right now. We feel it. We get it. We're trying to improve. We recognize there's a need to improve the delivery of certain services related to capacity and scoring. We're committed to that. We've got a partner in AML that's going to assist with that. And I believe that with those tools in place, we're going to get to this point where the communities that Representative McKay, is there an end to this? We will get to a better point 5 and 10 years from now. So,
are there any further questions? I have quite a few, but I'm still trying to figure out just how to ask them. So I think I'll just take it upon myself to reach out to you from my office, and I don't think it's out of the question to think that we might not have you guys back again. So are there any further questions before we conclude this morning? Comments? I want to thank you for giving us your time all three mornings that you were here and dealing with all of our technical difficulties and I don't want to call it musical chairs, but I guess musical committee rooms. We had that technical difficulty. So I guess that's all we have this morning for the Community and Regional Affairs. It is 8:58 a.m. I call this meeting adjourned.